Locate in your Bible or pew Bible, Hebrews chapter 11, and also Genesis. We'll be bouncing back to Genesis to cover the story of one of our heroes. We've been, for much of the winter, camped out in Hebrews chapter 11 because our theme verse comes from Hebrews chapter 11. And Hebrews chapter 11 has been known by many to be called the Hall of Fame of Faith. There's just different characters, not perfect people, but faith-filled people in their story that we've been covering for much of winter. And so we've just taken name by name, line by line, and covering their story together. And this week it will be Joseph. Since we're seven characters in, though, I thought it was a good opportunity to come up for some air and to test your knowledge. We've got the incentive right next to me. Maybe some of you have given up candy for Lent. This is a temptation then. Or you realize that Sundays are not counted in the 40-day sequencing from Ash Wednesday until Easter Sunday. And so maybe there's an exception. I don't know how you want to play that. But here's the game. You are going to tell me something about the faith journey of one of the characters that we've studied so far in our study. And if you can't, you owe me candy. If you can, I give you candy. Okay? This is the deal, and these are the characters so far that we've covered together. The first week in our Hebrews 11 study was Abel. Can anyone tell me something about Abel's faith journey that stuck out in that study? My office is like right next to that door. You can start dropping the candy in now. No one? Abel? No one's got Abel? Oh, man. Front row. What is it, Teresa? Abel did what he did because he wanted to, not necessarily because he was supposed to. If you remember, Abel's story starts with a sacrifice, with an act of worship to God. And it says Abel brought the choice, the fat portions, the best. Cain did not. He brought the leftovers, the half-dead. And Abel's sacrifice was accepted and Cain's wasn't. That triggered the first cold-blooded murder case that was brother against brother. It was Cain killing Abel. Not always does faithfulness get rewarded on this side of eternity, right? Abel's story certainly didn't. He was cold-blood killed for doing the right thing. Sometimes you will do the right thing and get wrong results. We don't keep accounting on this side of eternity. Faith sometimes has to live forward and look beyond. And Abel's story reminds us of that. Good, good. Test number one passed. What about test number two? Enoch. Who can tell me something about Enoch's faith journey? Rosemay. There's not much said about Enoch in the Bible, but the one thing that's said two times of Enoch's journey is that he walked faithfully with God. And he's only one of two people in Scripture that's never said to have died, Enoch and Elijah, and it's walking faith. How do you walk faithfully? Just living day in and day out with this faithful bent towards God. Enoch's story reminds us of that. Good, Rosemary, good. Let's go to question number three, Noah. Who can tell me anything about Noah and his faith journey? Come on, this is the easiest one of the top three on the list. Someone give me something about Noah. He did what he was told, which was
build an ark.
In the middle of a desert where there was no water, he faithfully did what seemed confusing and dumb and just stupid to so many around. But when the skies opened up for 40 days and 40 nights, apparently doing the thing that God tells you to do is the best thing that you can do. And Noah's story is a story of judgment and salvation, depending on how we respond to the leading of God in our life. So very good. Noah, number four, it's actually a two-parter. Abraham's story we covered in two different weeks, a beginning of Abraham's journey and an ending of Abraham's journey. Who can tell me something about Abraham's journey? Reese? Abraham was obedience. Was that one of those church words that you're tossing out? Like Jesus might be a right answer, obedience might be a right answer, the Bible. I'll give it to you, Reese. I'll give it to you. It is obedience. Abraham was living far, far, far away. And God said, I've got a different land for you, Abraham, and all of your offspring, but it's going to take a step of uncomfortable, a step of faith. You've never been to this land. You've only heard me talk about this land. Do you trust me enough to go to this land? And Abraham, as a senior citizen, went stepping. 75-year-old man, he took God up on his word and he went to that land that God had told him about that becomes the promised land for Abraham and his offspring. It was an act of obedience, stepping out in the uncomfortable, but Abraham's journey reflected that. Can anyone tell me something about the latter part of Abraham's life? That was the beginning of his journey, but it was a two-parter. Can someone tell me about Abraham's faith journey at the end of it? Front row, Jesse. He trusted God and didn't withhold his son Isaac. And that is the story of sacrifice. Like, God puts some things in our hands. Do we clutch onto those things? Or are we open-handed towards the things of God? Abraham was open-handed. God put some things in his hand, and Abraham realized, I don't own them. They're ultimately God's. I steward them, I manage them, but he's the owner of them. And so that was really reflected through this test with his kids. He didn't cling to his kids. He realized his kids were ultimately his gift from God. And so if God's saying something, I'm going to obey what he says, even as it relates to my kids. And so he showed that in a great act of sacrifice, that final test in Abraham's journey. What about Isaac? That's Abraham's kid, right? What can you tell me about Isaac's journey of faith as reflected? In the balcony, Eli. Isaac's faith was also seen through that same setting. He submitted. He surrendered. It seems physically, Isaac was probably the stronger one. Abraham's a senior citizen. Isaac's the one carrying the wood up a mountain. And yet he allowed himself to be bound. And so faith is surrendered. Faith allows itself in a surrendered way. You're really going to test this arm, huh? It's not softball season yet, Eli, but we're going balcony for you, man. I'll sign autographs afterwards, okay? Be right back there. What about Jacob? What can you tell me about Jacob's journey? We got to spread the wealth, Jesse, huh? Can anyone else tell me about Jacob? They can't. Jesse, double claim.
His name means deceiver.
Jacob gets a different name. His name, Jacob, means deceiver. He grasps at the heel, but he gets a new name, Israel, which means struggles with God. We're going to talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on. He's a trickster in Scripture, kind of a shady figure, and yet he made the Hall of Fame of Faith. Why? Because God struggles even through the shadiness and teaches and reveals something about himself that makes an impact on Jacob. The Jacob at the beginning of Jacob's story and the Jacob at the end of Jacob's story are two different characters, even though it's the same person, because God's done a work through the wrestle of life that shapes this trickster into Israel. Jacob gets a name change into Israel, one who struggles with God. So very good, very good. You passed the test. I don't get candy this time. You get it. But I'm going to, my gift to you, tell you for the next 40 minutes about this next character for us. And so the gift just keeps giving, doesn't it, today? Joseph is our next character in this Heroes of Faith story. And his story is one of the twists and turns in life. Anyone's life ever been going one direction only to make a sharp turn in a different direction? To feel like you're going one way and then going this way and then going this way and then going this way? Like, the twists and turns of life is Joseph's life story. It looks good and then it looks really bad. And then it looks good and then it looks bad again. And so we're going to cover his life story and how it relates to our faith journey as well, found in Hebrews chapter 11. So his story in Hebrews 11, found in verse number 22. Shout out that page number where 1122 is, and we'll get this journey started. 1716, thank you. 1716, verse number 22. Just one verse on Joseph that says this. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. There's a long backstory behind this that we're going to dig into in the book of Genesis. But the point I want to make up front is that Joseph's faith looked forward. He made a name for himself in Egypt, and yet he wasn't living for Egypt. You catching that? He made a name for himself in Egypt. He was a slave that rose to second in command. He literally saved a nation from 7 years of famine. He made a name for himself in Egypt, but he wasn't living for Egypt. And the symbolism of wanting his bones to go to the promised land showed that Joseph wasn't living for Egypt. He was living for a land yet to come. And so this highlights in our faith journey of what land are we living in? Remember the last three characters, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, now Joseph? They've all been dancing around verse number 13, a couple paragraphs back, that says this: all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things they promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. They weren't living for just earth. They were living for eternity. They realized this world was not their home. They were foreigners and strangers. There was a home yet to come. I shared with you last week, and I hacked it up rather heavily, but I shared with you last week that there are some appetites on earth that won't be met, and that's a good thing, because you weren't made just for earth. You will have some unfulfilled appetites and desires that you will die with having those unmet, and that's reason for that, because you weren't created just for this life. You were created for a life to come. And so I tried to inform you on a C.S. Lewis quote about ducks and food and all of those arrangements, and I hacked it up so heavily, I said, this week I got to do a repeat and just give them the full quote. But it ties into this: don't live just for earth. You're a stranger and foreigner. Your home is yet to come. C.S. Lewis put it this way: the Christian says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. So a baby feels hunger. Well, there's such thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfies it, it does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it and to suggest the real thing. If that is so, then I must take care that on the one hand, never to despise or to be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other hand, never to mistake them for something else of which they're only a kind of copy, an echo, a mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find until after death. I must never to let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life to press on to that country and to help others to do the same. That's how faith lives. That's how Joseph lived. He wasn't living for Egypt. And even his burial arrangements highlighted that Egypt was not his home. He was looking forward to a home yet to come. This is how faith lives. It lives forward. And church, this is good news. That means if you're truly a Christian, your best life is in front of you, not behind you. Do you hear that? Your golden decade, the best era of your life, it isn't that way, it's this way. It's in front of you. If you're a Jesus follower, your best life is before you, not behind you. That's good news. That gives you something to wake up to this day, knowing you're one day closer to that day. Catching this? Faith lives forward, and it's a good thing when you truly understand the direction that faith is leading you. So how's that relate to Joseph? And are there twists and turns getting to that forward country? You betcha. Let's get to Genesis and see Joseph's story about how this journey unfolds. And so Joseph's journey begins in Genesis 37. That's the first book of the Bible. Find chapter 37. Shout out that page number so that we can all get there. 54, thank you. Genesis 37, we're going to begin in verse number 2. It's found on page 54 of your pew Bible. God's word says this: this is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah and his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. So we learned about Jacob last week, Jacob's dad of Joseph. And Jacob's family is a dysfunctional family. We said that about all heroes of faith, right? They do some things really well and some things really bad. God's not highlighting them in the Hall of Fame because they batted 1,000. That's not how you get in the Hall of Fame. There are some things Jacob made contact with. There's other things that he was totally whiffing at in life. And his home life was one of those whiffs. It was dysfunctional in a variety of different directions, as we're going to discover. Joseph's one of those kids. One of those kids born later in Jacob's life journey. He's got a lot of half-brothers, at least 10 of them, of half-siblings. And so he's bringing them a bad report. So last week, we talked in Jacob's journey about wrestling, because part of Jacob's journey was this wrestling match with God, like we brought up a moment ago in our sharing time. I'm pretty sure Jacob's family was multi-sport athletes, because they go into baseball season right after this, okay? So work with me here. Last week was wrestling. This week is baseball. And maybe, yes, I'm doing this for Andy Dennings because I like seeing the baseball players outside and they should have a beautiful week of it. So talk baseball a moment for me, okay? There's three strikes and you're out in baseball. And Joseph's playing some baseball here. Strike number one, all of the siblings work for Dad. It's a shepherding business. Jacob's the master shepherder. All of his children live among the flocks and work among the flocks. Well, in working with half-brothers, Joseph brings other brothers a bad report back to boss man, back to Dad. He speaks badly about his brothers. Now, truth be told, if you know something about Joseph's half-brothers, there was probably plenty to report, right? There was plenty of bad that made up his half-brother's lives. But he's the tattletale. He's the snitch. He goes and tells Dad a bad report. Strike one. You're still surviving in strike one. Strike one, right? Strike two happens next, verse 3. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he'd been born to him in his old age, and he made him an ornate robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Strike number one's the bad report. Strike number two's the robe. And this wasn't something Joseph chose for himself, but it was a symbol that Dad put on self. It was an ornate robe. We're somewhat unaware what an ornate robe is. It's the only time that word is used in the Hebrew text. Many think it might develop or revolve around the color of the robe. And so we get plays and dramas that talk about Joseph in the multicolored dream coat there, the technicolored dream coat. With that in mind, it could have been. We're not told exactly. It might have been the length of the robe or the style of the robe. Remember, clothes in the ancient world were not one-click Amazon next-day delivery, right? It's a long, lengthy process. It's hard to get the materials. It's hard to make material into the fabric themselves, and then from the fabric into the design. And so color, style, didn't worry about that. Let's go practicality. And remember, Joseph's kids are shepherds. You don't wear tuxedos to the sheep, right? There's something different about this robe that Dad gifts to Joseph, but not all other brothers, that communicates to everyone in the room, hey, Dad loves me, but I don't know what he feels about you. Parents, there's a lesson in this. As parents, we're to love all of our children, play favorites with none of them. Does that mean that there's a child that we have that we might not have more personalities or hobbies or common interests? Yes. Does that mean that that child is the only one to receive or needs our love? No. We're the adult, remember. We got to work hard then to show that love to all. It might be easy to show love in this extreme, but we might have to learn new hobbies or new habits to communicate love to all the children God gives us, because that role of father is for all of them, not just for one of them. You catching this? It's very important. It gets very dysfunctional when mom and dad start playing favorites. God's call to the adult parent is to love all of them. And each one of them needs to know that daddy loves them. Mommy loves them. And so sometimes that means getting down on the floor and playing Barbies when baseball might be more up your alley, huh? This is the call of daddies in this privilege of parenting that we've been ushered into. Jacob's not doing it here. It's obvious to everyone in the room, he loves Joseph. Everyone else in the room is wondering how daddy feels about them, but they know how he feels about him. You catching that? Strike two. Strike three unfolds from that. Verse 5 says, Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. And he said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. His brothers said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. He had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream. This time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he told his father as well as his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept this matter in his mind. Strike one, bad report. Strike two, ornate robe. Strike three, the dream. And telling the dream to others. Now let's back up a moment. This is the Old Testament. The Bible has not been written at this point. God's way of revealing himself at times in Scripture is through dreams and visions. They don't have the book yet. And so God is still trying to reveal himself to them. And so he gives them dreams and visions. He's done this to Joseph. He gives him a dream and a vision of something that's going to transpire in his life. But he gave it to Joseph. And Joseph tells it to brothers. You see the problem in this? God's revealing himself to Joseph. And the dream has to do with something that Joseph's life is going to do and the ripple effect it's going to have for the positive ways. It's not a dream for brothers. But Joseph's got to go and tell brothers. Because there's something in this dream that probably makes Joseph feel a little good. His dream is that there's some sheaves that bow down to his sheaf. Like grains of wheat that bowing down to his wheat. And the symbolism behind that is there's enough sheaves to count for all of his half-brothers, and they're bowing down to him. Then he has another dream similar to that one, only this time this star has other stars bowing down to him, including the sun and the moon. The parents creep into this one. Dad at first rebukes son for this dream, but then he ponders it further because remember, Jacob had some journey with his own dreams, right? That wrestling match with God last week. So Jacob's aware of some dreams and some ways God reveals himself. But remember, this is a dream for Joseph. And Joseph has to brag to tell it to brothers. And that's just going to be a bad situation, even getting worse, right? It's benches clearing. The dugouts are out. They want Joseph, tossed out of this thing, right? And they're going to make sure it happens. They're just looking for an opportunity. Here comes the opportunity. Verse 12. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. Very well, Joseph replied. So he said to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. And then he sent Joseph off to the valley of Hebron. So brothers are doing the work. Man in the tuxedo, Joseph, he's not with brothers. Interesting, huh? Little favoritism played even in the family business. But dad needs a management report now, huh? So he sends Tuxedo Boy over to half-brothers to see what's really going on in the fields. That's Joseph's mission. And so he's strolling in that ornate robe, right? Checking out brothers and seeing how they're doing with their job and their work. And brothers see him in the distance and start hatching a plan. He's on strike three. It's fight time. Let's go. And so this is how it goes down. Verse number 23. Skip down with me. When Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, that ornate robe that he was wearing. And they took him and they threw him in a cistern. And the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. They sat down to eat their meal, and they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. You catching their game plan strategy? See Joseph in a distance. They see the emblem of favoritism all over him. He's strutting in that robe. They hatch a plot. Let's do away with him. And plan A is let's throw him in the cistern and let's just let him die there. A dark, cold place. We'll see how much that favored boy likes that. And then they see a different opportunity arise. Some traitors. They're not carrying goods. They're carrying cargo, not people, I should say. Spices and myrrh. They're heading down to Egypt. Brothers see it from a distance. They say, I wonder if they'll barter with bodies. Can we traffic our brother? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. It will pad our pockets. We'll know a clean conscience that Joseph isn't at least dead in some dark hole, so we'll feel better about ourselves. We'll have more money in our pockets, and favored boy will be out of the equation. They like that option. They all agree, let's do that. And so they sell brother for 20 shekels, which isn't even a lot of money in that day and age. They're just that sick of him and fed up with him that they'll take pennies to be away and to be rid of them. And that's what happens. Joseph starts the day as a son, favored son, loved son, ends the day as a slave, wearing a robe. That robe's going to be torn and dipped in blood before the day's done. Read this as it unfolds, verse 31. They got Joseph's robe, they slaughtered a goat, they dipped the robe in the blood, they took the ornate robe back to their father. They said, we found this, examine it, see whether it's your son's robe. Jacob recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. Some ferocious animals devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, and he put on sackcloth, and he mourned for his sons many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but they refused to be comforted. No, he said, I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave. And so his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph to Egypt, to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Is that a bad day or what, church, huh? You start the day a son, you end the day a slave. You start the day with clothes on your back, you end the day with that robe torn, dipped in blood, and it used as a frame job to convince your father that you've been torn apart by wild beasts and that you're no more, and it sends him into weeping. Like, is that a bad day or what? Do people of faith have bad days? You betcha. He's in the Hall of Fame of Faith, correct? People of faith have bad days too. How do people of faith respond to bad days? That's a bigger question. Do you sit and mope and say, my best life is behind me? There's no point in living this day. I'm just stuck here. My life is done. I was dead back in Canaan. Now I'm in Egypt. That option was open before Joseph, right? Just sit and stay and mope and complain about the life you once had, not about the life you have presently. Or, to be cliche, when life throws you lemons, do you make lemonade? Do you bloom where you're planted? He's no longer a son, he's a slave. Is he going to make the best of this situation, or is he always going to be moping and wishing that he was still the son? Let's see what he does. Let's see how faith responds, shall we? Flip over to chapter 39. It's the next glimpse of Joseph's journey that we get. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, verse 1 says, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who'd taken him there. And so captain of the guard, think military. Joseph sold into slavery. He lands in the household of someone that's a high-ranking Egyptian official. He's in the military. He's influential. And Joseph's just a slave in his entourage. This is Potiphar. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When the master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in the eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. And with Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Is Joseph making lemonade out of lemons? Is he sitting and moping and saying, I'm stuck here in life? Or is he trying to make the most of this moment in life, even though he's not where he wants to be in life? He doesn't want to be in Egypt. He doesn't want to be a slave. And he's working through that, right? He's doing something with that. And God, as he's doing something, God is doing something. You catching that? He's blessing Joseph even in a sad situation in life, even in Egypt. God is blessing him and moving through him and doing something to him and through him, even in Egypt. He's blessing Potiphar because he's blessing Joseph. And Potiphar trusts the slave. He makes him in charge of his household. The only thing he worries about is what he's going to order that evening on the menu. Everything else is in Joseph's care. He's doing a good job in a tough situation to do a good job in. Let's see how it pays off. Verse 6, Joseph was a well-built and handsome man. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. Joseph apparently is doing too good of a job that other people take notice who shouldn't be noticing. Potiphar is a married man. His spouse recognizes Joseph, sees some things in Joseph, pursues Joseph. This is a tempting situation because remember, how old is Joseph when he was sold into slavery? 17. He's a teenager. He's either a teenager or in his young 20s at this point in the journey. Is that a hormone-induced time or what? Huh? Here's sexual temptation knocking on the door to a teenager 20-something-year-old. How's he going to respond? Let's see his morals. Verse 8. Joseph refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he's entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master's withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. He's trying to avoid the tempting situation as is. That's a good advice for battling temptation. Don't even go near that, right? It's how Joseph's trying to practice his life. Put up some walls, not even pursue that, entertain that. He knows the hormones. He knows the urges. He's a teenager. He's a 20-something. He's not going there, though, because he respects his master, Potiphar. He knows this is Potiphar's wife, and because he respects his master, right? It's both a human love and a God love. He knows this is not God's will for his life, and he wants to do it God's way. This is a respectable, ethical, moral decision by this teenager or 20-something, isn't it? This is good stuff. Let's see how it plays out. One day he went to the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out the house. When she saw that he left his cloak in her hand and run out the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came here to sleep with me, but I screamed. And when he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until the master came home. Then she told him this story. The Hebrew slave you brought came to make sport of me, but as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and he ran out the house. When his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me, he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him, put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Joseph did the right thing, right? Was it the right result? He did the right thing. He made the right decision. Gets thrown in the slammer for it? It's the ideal he said, she said situation, right? And very tough to see which side is telling the truth. And this is what Joseph, a slave with no status, is caught into. Say maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I will give you some clues that I think are important, and maybe you'll find them. Potiphar, we said a moment ago, he's military, right? He doesn't have a problem with killing people. This was his job. This was his business. He had people working for him to do this. He was military. Don't you find it interesting that military man only throws Joseph in prison and doesn't kill him? Like, this is a slave. No rights in Egyptian society. Does he have any trouble telling his men if he really believes wife's story, off with his head? I think there's a clue in this text that Potiphar knows his character, but also knows his public image. His wife's telling him a story, and publicly, we got to save face amongst my peeps, but I know Joseph and his character, and I've put a lot of things in his hand, and he's been trustworthy. I know he wouldn't do this. I think he might be believing Joseph's story by what he does to Joseph in the story and doesn't kill him, just sends him to prison. That doesn't help Joseph, though, right? It's still prison. You were making lemonade. Life was hard on you. You were favored, then you were a slave, and you were finally starting to climb the ladder again, and life was finally looking good, and then this happens yet again. And it's a big, huge step back this time. It's prison. This isn't prison in prison reform days, 17th, 18th century. This is ancient prison. Fleas, vermin, rats, sanitation. Like, this is a dark place in Joseph's faith journey for doing the right thing, right? Does faith always get rewarded on this side of eternity? Not in the instant, not in the moment. Joseph's living that right now, right? It's hard. And yet, what's he going to do with this hard situation, right? Twist, turn, he's doing the right thing. Now twist, turn again. How's he going to respond the second time through when life throws him more lemons? Let's find out. While Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him and showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those that he had in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. He's in a dark situation again, and he's making the best of the darkness. Isn't this impressive? Isn't this faith's response to hard times, to bloom where you're planted, to truly make lemonade, a sweetness out of the sour bitterness of life sometimes? Like, Joseph's doing this, right? In prison. He still just keeps working and moving and trying to do the next right thing. And God sees that. God values that. God blesses that. He's starting to climb some ranks even in prison, which is going to set him up for his biggest break in life and where the picture starts to make sense for all the bad breaks that it was before. Chapter 40, verse 1. Sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker and the king of Egypt offered their master, the king of Egypt, or rather offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, and the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in that same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned to them Joseph, and he attended them. And after he'd been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, went to the prison where Joseph was warden. They had a dream that same night, and each of them had a meaning of its own. When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. And so he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, "Why do you look so sad today?" "We both had dreams," they answered, "but there's no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." Joseph had a history with dreams, right? And he realized God was speaking some things through those things. And so he's trying to see, is God at work through these things? I just love that Joseph's doing his work in the midst of a bad situation. Like, this break opportunity happens when he's just doing his job in prison and noticing people, right? As he's making his rounds, he notices two people are looking sad. Now it's prison, right? I imagine there's plenty of days where plenty of people are looking sad, but he cares enough to know the nuances of people, to care enough about them to know when this look is a different than yesterday's look, right? He notices that this sadness is different than the sadness when he first met them. And so he asks them about that. What's going on in life? And they open up about their life. And the sadness has to do with some confusion about dreams.
ways that they feel like God was maybe breaking through that they weren't having answers to. And that opens a dialogue where Joseph's able to tell them some things about the dreams. And then it plays out. I'm going to fast forward in the story for time's sake. But it plays out exactly how Joseph said it would play out, as revealed by God. Okay? So one of them offended Pharaoh, he's going to be done away with. And another one who offended Pharaoh, he's going to be restored to his position. It plays out just exactly as Joseph said it. He says to the one that is going to be back in his position, he said, hey, give me a little shout out, letter of reference. When you get back to Pharaoh's palace, I'm in prison, and it was for something I never did. I'm getting bad results for right behavior. Can you just speak my name to Pharaoh and see if there's a promotion in order for me? I would really like to get out of prison. Can you help me out with that? And so he tells that to this friend before he gets promoted. You think friend does it? Not initially. Verse 41, or chapter 41, verse 1, when 2 full years had passed. Did you hear that? When 2 full years had passed. So all this went down 2 years ago. Joseph asked for a recommendation 2 years ago, right? Joseph was hoping to get out of prison 2 years ago. Like, sometimes this faith journey doesn't happen fast, and you stay in dark places longer than you'd like to be there. Joseph's been there in his journey, right? He was already in prison, and now 2 more years in prison before, oh, forgetful friend remembers something based on situations in life. Verse 9 for me in chapter 41. The chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, today I'm reminded of my shortcomings. Pharaoh was angry with his servants, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream that same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. Now a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretations of his dream. All these things turned out exactly as he interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position. The other man was impaled. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought before the dungeon. He had been shaved, changed his clothes, and he came before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. I love that humility of Joseph. I don't know that he had it back in chapter 37 when he's telling brothers some things that were intended just for him. I don't know that he had that humility a couple decades before this, but he's learned some things on his faith journey. And you see it by what he said to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I heard you can interpret some dreams. Joseph replied, I cannot, but God can. That's a humble response, right? I cannot, but God can. The answers aren't in me, it's in him. And it's a witnessing opportunity then. For Pharaoh, this pagan king that hears a witness of a person just humbly walking out their faith, pointing them to God. I cannot, but God can. And God does in this scenario. Joseph reveals the dream to Pharaoh that ends up being this dream of 7 years of abundance and 7 years of famine. Like God's trying to warn this pagan king of the next 14 years in his kingdom. And there's 7 years of abundance, and they're going to need to hold on to that because 7 years of famine is following behind it. And so there needs to be a plan in place because people's lives are at stake there. And so Joseph is able to say this to Pharaoh to make a plan in place. And Pharaoh's hearing all this, and he's saying, who's got a better plan than you, Joseph? I want you to be this man that helps us these next 14 years, that saves our nation, our people. That ends up saving Joseph and his family. I'm fast-forwarding through the rest of Genesis here. But this not only saves Egypt, it saves Joseph's family. And there's a journey of forgiveness. You remember those brothers that sold him to slavery? Joseph saves their life too in the process and saves not only Egypt, but Israel, the people of God. Through some dark years, through some lemon years, through some he said, she said situations that went bad for him, he stayed the course, and God used that to save these two nations, these families, these individual lives. What's the lesson we draw from all this? I'm just giving you one today. But hear this lesson. Faith's journey can get curvy. Keep going. Faith's journey can get curvy. By curvy, I mean twist and turn. You think you're going one way, adjust course immediately. Favored son turns into slave overnight, right? Privileged robes turns into shredded, dipped in blood, and dad thinks you're dead, right? Life changes quickly, drastically. It's curvy. But what's Joseph do through every twist and turn? He blooms where he's planted. He makes lemonade with life's lemons. He stays the course. He stays faithful. And God's doing something that's actually setting him up to be in the perfect place at the perfect time to save not only his life, but his family and a nation. Joseph will say very later on in the journey, the closing chapter of Genesis, his brothers are groveling before Joseph's feet. Dad just died. They're worried that Joseph's gonna sell them into slavery now. Do to them what they did to him. And so they're pleading for their life. And Joseph says these iconic words in Genesis chapter 50. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. There were some real hurts and harms in Joseph's journey. Let's not make light of that. But he could see beyond that to the bigger picture. You intended to hurt and harm me. God intended it for the good to accomplish what's now being done. I hear pages shuffling and stuff like that. Can I still finish with two more stories? One of those takes place at Yosemite. I've shared stories with many of you on a one-to-one basis. Our family's getting ready this summer to take a Western adventure, and so we've swapped stories about different national parks. I'll share with you, growing up, my family didn't take many vacations at all, and so my first opportunity to see so much of America was through college football trips and track trips that we got to take as a part of college athletics. Very first kind of eye-opening moment in my life journey was Yosemite National Park. My wife and kids have not seen it, and so this is one of the destinations on our Western adventure because I would like them to see it and kind of see if it's what I remembered it to be a decade or plus ago of college days. And so we had a track meet out in California, Fresno, California. Anyone must-see list, Fresno, California? Probably not. California's beautiful in places. Fresno's not that place. That's where the track meet was. But our college had carved out after the track meet an opportunity to take a day trip to Yosemite. And I remember the van ride out to Yosemite, hearing all about this national park there. Van ride to Yosemite was nothing to write home about. Like, it was California, like, towards summertime. And that's just, like, brownness and barrenness. Doesn't rain there anytime, let alone summertime. It's not a pretty ride out there from Fresno to there. You go through this tunnel once you get in Yosemite, and it just goes dark. And it's just a typical drive-through tunnel, lights on every side. But once you get through the tunnel, there's death and barrenness. There's a tunnel and darkness. And then you come out of the tunnel, and you see this. There's a waterfall in the horizon. You get the big granite mountains there, the green lush valley beneath it. Like, it was just like a wide-eyed opening moment for me as a college kid, not seeing national parks, let alone Yosemite National Park with that. And the lesson in all this is there's twists and the brownness and barrenness and darkness to get to beauty. Isn't that Joseph's journey? Sold as a slave, thrown in a dungeon, 2 years of waiting when the recommendation form gets lost, and then you're second in command in Egypt, and you're saving a nation, and you're saving your family, and forgiveness is being, like, brownness, darkness, and then bam, life gets twisty and turny and curvy. Keep going. You don't know what the next sight is that you're going to see and how God connects the dots together. Can I illustrate that one step further? This one is more kid-friendly version. When I'm typing the sermon manuscript this week, the thought that keeps popping in my head is my kid's little favorite movie, one of them, Finding Nemo, and Dory's comments. You know what I'm talking about if you've seen Finding Nemo or Finding Dory. Dory, the simplistic fish that she is, she's profound, and her sage old advice is just keep swimming. She's got to go through some stuff, right? Those jellyfish sting her. Ouch. Sharks are out to get her. She's lost. She's connected to this control freak clownfish that's in a personal crisis and all that. Like, it's hard. And yet she just keeps swimming and just keeps swimming and helps others around her just keep swimming. Like, is there life in this? That's Joseph's story, isn't it? He's in the hall of fame of faith. Do you think faith has to just swim through some times that are hard and under attack and not making sense? This is what it means to live the faith journey. Your life is going to take some twists and turns that you won't be able to make sense of in the moment. Trust him in those moments and just keep swimming. Do the next right thing, even when the next right thing yields wrong results. Still stay faithful to him. You catching this? This is the faith journey that we're invited on. That's Joseph's doing and doing well. May the same be said of our life too. Amen?